Romans chapter 12. Romans chapter 12. We'll read this, and then we'll work our way through some of these things. Ruth and Chris Fenn and Sheila decorated. And I don't think any of them are up here, right? So I need to move some of this because it's in my standing way. Hopefully it doesn't mess anything up. I move my feet a lot back here and stepping on the green fern. So I hope that they don't get offended by me moving that. All right, Romans chapter 12, verse 1. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that ye present your bodies a living sacrifice, wholly acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service. And be not conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that ye may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. Now, we looked last week at, of course, verse 1 there. And Paul, we called this the pastoral plea, Paul's pastoral plea to his people. I beseech you, right? He's pleading with them. He's begging them. And he's not commanding them. He's not demanding them, but rather he's entreating them that they would, because of the mercies of God, because of all that God has done for them and all that he has outlined so far in this book, he's saying, based upon these things, not based upon my merit, not based upon my persuasive speech, not based upon my credibility as Paul the Apostle, but based on the mercies of God that he has demonstrated and poured out upon you, based upon that, I'm beseeching you that you would give your whole life. You would present your body a living sacrifice. And we talked, of course, about what that means. We talked about some examples of what a living sacrifice might look like, some models of that in the New Testament. And then, of course, we came to understand that this is what would be called our reasonable service. This is the logical response when we are confronted with who God is and all that he has done for us. The logical response, the reasonable response, is that we would lay down our life as a living sacrifice. But Paul now continues, because what does a living sacrifice now look like? And as we go through chapters 12 and 13 and 14, a little bit in 15, we see that Paul now uses this as sort of a foundational teaching. What does a living sacrifice look like in relation to the church? We'll see later in chapter 12. What does a living sacrifice look like in relation to the government? We look at that in Romans chapter 13. What does it look like between one another in our relationships? In various formats. So how does a living sacrifice relate to the world around us is what we'll cover in 12 and 13 and 14. But in order for us to become not just a willing sacrifice, but also a usable sacrifice, Paul leads us then into the sort of the next logical step, which is verse number 2. And he starts with a negative and a positive. He starts first, he says, be not conformed to this world, but be transformed. The negative, of course, is don't be conformed, but be transformed. And I want to just talk this morning a little bit about this first phrase, be not conformed to this world. You know, we use the word world a lot in our Christian speak. We say, things are getting really bad out there in the world, or don't let your kids go out into the world. You know, we use this as a phrase a lot. But the world also is used in John 3:16, isn't it? For God so loved the world. So sometimes these phrases that we use can be a little confusing or a little hard to understand, perhaps, if we haven't necessarily thought through those. So I thought it'd be useful this morning to start with Paul, where he says we need to resist the world, resist the world. And I want to talk just simply about what is the world this morning. What is the world? Why is there a conflict between the world and the church, or between the world and Christians? And see if we can't draw some principles from that. If you would just turn with me to start to Isaiah chapter 14. Isaiah 14. and we will see the beginning of this thing that we call the world. Isaiah 14. And all through this chapter, there is discussion, but I'm just going to kind of focus really in on verse number 12. He says, "How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer?" Now, Lucifer was, of course, is, of course, the devil. Lucifer, the devil or Satan, was an angel. He was called an angel of light. He would, I believe, from what we can understand, he would have been the angel in charge of the music in heaven and would have led the choirs and the instruments and the musicians and all the other angels as they would have sang or played instruments and things like that. So Lucifer had a place of leadership, a place of prominence as an angel. And so have that understanding as God now speaks to him. He says, "Son of the morning, how art thou cut down to the ground, which didst weaken the nations?" Verse 13, "For thou hast said in thine heart, I will ascend into heaven, I will exalt my throne above the stars of God, I will sit also upon the mount of the congregation in the sides of the north, I will ascend above the hosts of the clouds, I will be like the Most High." In verse 15, "Yet thou shalt be brought down to hell." Now, what happens is, at some point here, as Lucifer is in heaven, as he is leading the choirs, as this praise and worship is going on, in his heart he begins to envy the Lord in the glory that he is receiving. Becomes envious of it. And that seed of envy and perhaps bitterness matures and grows, like all sin does, to a point where he would be saying in his heart, "I want to be like the Most High. I want to be above God. They should be worshiping and singing to me, not to God. I should be receiving the glory." And we know, of course, that this is the first transgression against God. This is, in the spiritual sense, not in the human sense. We know that Eve, of course, sinned first as a human, but this is the first recorded transgression against God, essentially. And we know that what happens is that the devil and a third of the angels, so he must have had, as we said, some sphere of influence. He was able to communicate with the other angels in some way, that they also were maybe supporting him or, in some way aligned with him. And God, at some point there, cast them out of heaven. Okay, so they are cast out of heaven. The devil, some go immediately to hell, some go to the earth, some are given the power to be able to to be able to move between hell and earth, and ultimately the devil, of course, comes to the earth, it seems like first, and dwells the body of a serpent and deceives Eve. Okay, so that's how the beginning of all of this occurs. The devil is the leader. He has a third of the angels, which would be perhaps hundreds of thousands, maybe even millions of what we would call now demons that he has a power over, authority over, and he comes into the earth. Okay, now let's turn to Genesis chapter 4. How does this, that's sort of where this all begins, but how does it progress from there? Well, of course, we know that, like I just said, the devil now comes and he indwells a serpent. Eve is deceived and sins. Adam sins with her. And God's perfect earth, his perfect garden, has been cursed now, or broken really by sin. And God puts a curse on the earth. Part of the curse includes the power given to the devil now to be the what's called the prince and power of the air. Okay, part of the curse is that man chose the devil as their leader, essentially. And so the Lord, while sovereignly in control, has given powers to the devil, essentially, to manipulate and to work out his own plan. essentially, Adam and Eve chose to listen to the serpent more than they chose to listen to God. And so part of the curse is you will live under the power and control of the devil, because that is what you have chosen. And so as that progresses, we come to chapter 4. And Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived and bare Cain and said, I have gotten a man from the Lord. Interesting, this verse, a total side note, but Eve believed that this was the Messiah. She believed that this would be her child that would redeem her people. And she again bare his brother Abel. Okay, and obviously I think most of us here would know the story of Cain and Abel. God calls for a sacrifice. Cain brings vegetables. Abel brings the right sacrifice, a lamb, obeys God. And God, of course, says to Cain, you know, why would you do this? And Cain and Abel end up having a fight. Why don't you look with me at verse 5. But unto Cain and to his offering he had no respect. God didn't respect his offering because he went against his word. And Cain was very wroth, and his countenance fell. Countenance here would be like his, like mood, not just sort of on a temporary basis, but it was a permanent sort of falling away, if you will. Now, this is someone who now has taken a significant step in the wrong direction. You know, sometimes perhaps you correct your children, and sometimes they receive your instruction, and you can see a change in attitude, and they move on. Sometimes you correct them, and you can tell, like, oh boy, that was, they've dug their heels in deeper. Like, you can sense, like, we're going to have to deal with this again, right? I've dealt with this in the moment, but I can tell this is something we're going to deal with again. This is where Cain is. Cain is really digging his heels in. He's saying, okay, you know, I am right, and God, you are wrong, and I'm going to continue to push this thing. Verse 6, and the Lord said to Cain, which I'm going to stop getting on rabbit trails here, but just this is interesting that the Lord is so present even at this time. I think this speaks to the relationship that Adam and Eve had with the Lord, that their relationship was so deep and was so intimate and was so pure that the Lord craved that. When he cursed the earth and when he cursed men and when he had to push them out, it would have been totally appropriate for the Lord to say, you're on your own, right? To sit in heaven and cross his hands and sit on his throne and say, you're on your own, you disobeyed. It would have been totally fine for him to do that. But instead, he continues to visit them, so much so that he can just pick up a conversation even with their sons, right? Hello, Cain. What's going on? How come you're upset today? Like a man talks to his friend. It's interesting. Why art thou wroth? Verse 6. And why is thy countenance fallen? If thou doest well, shalt thou not be accepted? If thou doest not well, sin lieth at the door. And unto thee shall be his desire, and thou shalt rule over him. Verse 8. And Cain talked with Abel his brother. And it came to pass when they were in the field that Cain rose up against Abel his brother and slew him. So Cain, obviously angry and bitter about this event, kills his brother Abel. And the Lord said unto Cain, where is Abel thy brother? And he said, I know not. Am I my brother's keeper? And he said, why hast thou done? What hast thou done? The voice of thy brother's blood crieth unto me from the ground. And now art thou cursed from the earth, which hath opened her mouth to receive thy brother's blood from thy hands. When thou tillest the ground, it shall not henceforth give thee strength. A fugitive and a vagabond shalt thou be in the earth. And Cain said unto the Lord, my punishment is greater than I can bear. And so, anyways, I just want to continue here. Cain rejects, of course, the Lord, rejects what the Lord has asked of him to do, grows bitter about it, kills his brother, then tries to cover it up. Of course, the Lord knows exactly what it is. And the Lord adds an additional curse onto Cain, saying, you're going to essentially have to depart from here. You're going to be a vagabond on the earth. Cain even doesn't accept God's punishment for him and says, oh, well, people are just going to kill me. Like, is that what you want? You want them just to kill me? And so God says, no, actually, I want you to endure this punishment for a long time. And so I'm going to put a mark upon you that others will know that you are protected from the Lord. Look down with me, if you will, at verse 16. And Cain went out from the presence of the Lord. That's significant, okay? This is the first human to depart from the presence of the Lord. And you might think, like, when the Garden of Eden was closed, they departed from the presence of the Lord. But that's not, it's clearly not the case. God was still very present in their life. And this is the first time, the first human who has said, nope, I'm out of here. And Cain went out from the presence of the Lord and dwelt in the land of Nod on the east of Eden. Cain knew his wife and bare a son. And then look at bare Enoch. This is not the righteous Enoch. This is the wicked Enoch. And he builded a city and called the name of the city after the name of his son Enoch. And so here we, you know, sort of have on and on. Now what's happening behind the scene here is that not only is the Lord still present, but also the devil is still present. You know, while the devil certainly has, been victorious in deceiving Eve and having them kicked out, and, you know, the devil is still very present. And we see Cain now depart from the presence of the Lord. And I believe that this means that he would have entered into the presence of the devil in a very real significant way. And he begins to basically set up his own life. Now, he's going to order and create his own life and his own family and his own cities and his own, all of these things, according to what? The way that he wants to do it, right? He's rejected the way that God has told them to do. And now he's going to create his own way of life. That would include, of course, government, right? He sets up a city. That city, of course, is going to have some structural government. Maybe it was, you know, some sort of a paternal order or, you know, whatever. But as the cities grew, you can see as you continue to read, more cities are built. This family begins to expand. We are covering in these verses here, maybe 300, 400, 500 years, something like that. So you could imagine these cities are growing. The families are growing. This is expanding. Well, there's obviously some sort of government. His philosophy would have been his own, right? It would have all come down to, what does Cain think about this? Cain's way of thinking is what would have been predominant. And I believe, when I say that, influenced, of course, by the devil. They would have, you know, figured out their own commerce. They would have figured out and prepared for themselves their own entertainment, right? They would have had their own holidays. They would have had they created their own way of life, totally absent from the presence of God, under the influence, really, of the devil. Okay? That is the first example that we have of what the Bible refers to as the world. It is an environment absent of God, controlled and influenced by the devil, with man and his fleshly desires totally left up to himself, creating for themselves their own culture, their own way of life, the way that they want to live, okay? That is, I think, the first and clearest example of the world. Now, how does this world experiment work out? Well, if you turn over to a couple of chapters, you get over, we've now, into chapter 6, we're now 1,000 years into the history of man. And of course, in verse 5, and God saw the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And it repented the Lord that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him at his heart. And the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, and the creeping thing and the fowls of the air, for it repenteth me that I have made them. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. After Cain, Eve bore another son. His name was Seth. Seth was a righteous man. And through the line of Seth comes Noah. Noah retained his ancestors' righteousness. And Noah found grace in the sight of the Lord. He was a holy man. It sounds very similar to Job, doesn't it? God looked throughout the earth trying to find someone that was holy or righteous. He finds Job. In the same way, God's looking for a man in this age. And he says, "Where is a righteous man out of all of the earth?" And he finds Noah and his three sons. And we know he puts them on the ark and protects them. But what does he do with the rest of Cain's heritage? eliminates them, doesn't he? What does he do with the rest of Seth's heritage? Eliminates them. The righteous father and the wicked father, both, their children, abandon God and go in their own way. That's the world. And very similarly, not in a flood, but in other ways, the end of the world always is destruction. It's always destruction. It's either destruction of themselves in self-destructive patterns and habits and cultures, or it's destructed by the Lord according to his sovereign will and his sovereign plan and sovereign way. So when we reach Romans chapter 12, if you would go back there with me for a minute, if you go back to Romans chapter 12 and verse number 2, you say, what then is Paul referring to when he says, be not conformed to this world? Well, Paul is living, of course, in the first century, so he's living in the very beginning of the turn of the century, or the beginning of present times, A.D., and this book probably is written in the early 60s, so the Roman Empire would have been the dominant empire in the world. And what you have now is you have, again, man going after and doing things the way that he wants to do things, outside of God's righteousness. God continuously has pleaded with the children of Israel, with the Jewish people, to follow his law, right? Doesn't he say over and over and over again, follow my law, do the way I'm telling you to do it. Obey, do what I'm telling you. This is for your good. This is the way you're supposed to live. And they don't. They continuously reject him. His chosen people rejected him. And Gentiles rejected him, didn't they? They also rejected him. That is why in the crucifixion of Jesus, you have to ask the question, well, who killed Jesus? Who killed Jesus? Well, was it the Jews? And you could argue, no, it was the Gentiles, because wasn't it Pilate? They went to Pilate, and Pilate gave the final command, right? Or was it the Jews? Because wasn't it the Jews who said, kill him, kill him, kill him? They pleaded with him. And then ultimately Jesus says, I lay down my own life, right? So who was involved in the crucifixion? They all were. Right? The Jews crucified Jesus. The Gentiles crucified Jesus. And ultimately Jesus himself gave his life. Right? So the world is now rejected fully, wholly has rejected God and all that he would have. And the Roman culture is the dominant culture of the day in the first century. But also, many would argue that the Roman culture is the dominant culture of our day as well. Right? There's the foundation of our, especially America, but Western civilization is rooted in the Roman culture. Roman law, even forms of entertainment, language, arts, all of that. Think about some of the most valuable art that's on the face of the earth today. It's really rooted in Roman roots. And so it's interesting how even today we're very influenced by that. That is a culture, again, that has rejected God and is trying its very best to create its own civilization, its own system. They have their own government, they have their own philosophy, they have their own economic structure, they have their own entertainments, all of these things. And really, it is a rejection from God. Now, America is a little unique in the sense that its roots and its foundings were, as the founders described it, an experiment. A group of individuals at a particular point in time had, under severe persecution, the opportunity to leave a country, find a place that they were able to come to and conquer, come and take over, essentially. They began and set up their civilization and culture in the way, again, that they thought it should be, right? Many of them, many of that, or the attraction for many in the world at that point was religious freedom. And truly a motivating factor for many, not all, but for many, in the coming to the United States was to find religious freedom. Lutherans were fleeing from Germany. Protestants were fleeing from England, right? There's all these different various groups from around the world who felt like once the new world was discovered, that they had an opportunity to go and to set up and to create their own culture. Many of the states in their forming were founded upon state religions. In fact, there was to such a degree that the founders said that if we were going to unite, we had to eliminate the influence of state governments at the federal level. They were fully aware and expected, I just was reading about this, they're fully aware and expected that every state would actually have its own state religion. And so Alexander Hamilton was intent that they wouldn't have a federal religion because he felt that the states would splinter if that happened. That was really the idea behind the thinking there. And that's what comes out in the First Amendment. Very different than the way that we think about it or interpret it today. But most states had their own grouping. It wasn't until really the early to mid-1800s, also playing into the Civil War, that states really were becoming, separating from their religions, really, and adopting the same position as the federal government and arguing instead for freedom of religion. All of the denominations were busy in that. Baptists were arguing that it should be Baptist. You know, Protestants were arguing it should be Protestant, Presbyterians. It was a combination, and they reached middle ground where they basically said, "Let's just allow religious freedom for everyone." That was a big deal because those religions were being funded by taxes, and so you had to have some religion that was in power say, or some denomination say, "We're not going to take your funding anymore from the federal government." As you know, once you start on federal government funding, it's hard to say no to that. But anyways, that's a part of the founding here. I said I wasn't going to go on more rabbit trails. That was a definite rabbit trail. All of this to say, man has continuously, over and over and over again, tried to create and set up and run their own culture and their own world in their own way. And it always tends to be be well-intentioned, but always goes further and further and further away from God. That is Romans chapter 1, right? It always goes further and further away from God, and tending ultimately, obviously, always to destruction. But when Paul says here, be not conformed to this world, you have to say, well, okay, so if there's this natural tension where you have a group of people, the church today, who believes God and wants to follow God and wants to do right, or the remnant of Israel, you know, in the time of the first century there, you've got, you know, people who are saying we want to follow God, and then you have the world which is pulling away from God. You have a natural tension between those things, okay? Just as an example of that, we believe that you should protect all life, right? And that means born and unborn. And the world, those who would reject God's teaching, would say, no, we think that abortion is totally fine. Is there tension between those ideas? Yeah, there is, right? There's real tension between that. That's perhaps a touching point at the moment. But when you really think about it, is there tension between the philosophy of the Bible and the philosophy of the world? There is, right? We don't want to begin a conversation this morning about Immanuel Kant or you know, Nietzsche or all of these philosophers and their evil, demonically inspired perspectives and views. But is the world fully believing and fully on board with a different philosophy than a philosophy that comes from the Bible? They are. Is the government of the world in a different place than the government of the Bible? I don't think any of us would disagree with that, right? We would all say that's absolutely true. What about forms of entertainment? Is the entertainment of the world very different than the entertainment that the Lord gives to us here in the Bible? It's very different, isn't it? And in each of those areas, there's tension, right? When I'm just sort of thinking about things here. When the United States went from being dry or closed on Sundays to open on Sundays, there was great tension about that, right? Remember the Prohibition? Was there tension? Of course there was tension in this country. So there's always going to be at these places tension. And that tension, that conflict is, as we should see it, really this idea that there is a very different way that the world thinks and operates and lives than the way that Christians are called to think and operate and live. Now, Jesus says we are in the world, but we are not of the world. Meaning that, yeah, we live presently in this world, and we are part of this culture. But we are not of, we are not from, the source of our life is not the world. And we are called to a different type of living. That type of living is mentioned in two places, one as salt, right, and one as light. Both of those are distinct. They stand out. They separate. Of course, we understand light and darkness, right? And when you turn on the light, it obviously sheds, it changes the atmosphere. It changes the environment. And in the same way, Christians are to be changing the environment of the world. But we are not removed from it yet, okay? And so when Paul is saying, be not conformed to this world, he's saying that the world is going to pressure you, is going to influence you, is going to be trying to mold you into a particular way, into a particular shape. The world is designed to push us into certain behaviors. And he's saying you have to be aware of that, be keen to that, and you have to resist it. Okay? This is one of the main, I would say, fundamental reasons why we would be so, I don't know what the right word here is. We would be so leery of or warning against, I don't know exactly what the right word is, but just we wouldn't want anyone to be under the influence of public education. You know, for our kids, it is they're obviously at their most vulnerable. And when you really think about it, you pack them up in the morning and you ship them off. They do their thing and you do your thing. And you come back at the end of the day and you say, hey, how was your day? It was fine. Yeah, it was good. Okay, good. Okay. Do you have a problem at school? That's the only time really a lot of parents get involved, as if there was a fight or something. Do parents really know what's being taught in our schools? I mean, they don't. Right? They don't. Are our kids in public school, are they learning a godly philosophy or a worldly philosophy? Are they learning godly science or worldly science, right? I don't think it's a sin to have your kid in public school. I don't think that's true at all. And I think that there are cases where it could be, in fact, the right thing. I think it's possible that that's true. I'm not condemning it. But I'm saying, oh, we have to be so careful about it. Because our kids are, from the very beginning, being indoctrinated into a idea, into a philosophy, into a way of thinking, into a way of seeing, into a totally different worldview than that of the worldview that the Bible and what God has called us to as Christians. We can't be salt if we're the same. We can't be light if we're the same. And it starts so early with our children. Why is it so insistent from the world that they control education? Because that's how they move their philosophy and move their agenda forward, right? This is just a simple sort of logical understanding of this. And Paul is saying we have to resist that. we've got to resist this. I just want to quickly show you a verse to tell you where all this ends. Revelation 19. Revelation 19. Where does all of this end? Revelation 19, 19. And I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies gathered together to make war against him that sat on the horse. Of course, it's Jesus. And against his army, that's us. And the beast was taken, the devil, and with him the false prophet that wrought miracles before him with which he deceived them that had received the mark of the beast and them that worshipped the image. Here it is. These both were cast alive into a lake of fire of burning with brimstone, and the remnant were slain with the sword of him that sat upon the horse, which sword proceeded out of his mouth, and all the fowls were filled with their flesh. Where does the world end? Ends in destruction. You know, there's a perspective on these verses that you could say, you know, that is it's a glorious and a victorious thing for God and for righteousness. But when you understand that it's your family and friends and neighbors that these verses are describing, it's not something that I think we can be victorious in, but rather heartbroken over and motivated to be evangelizing and being ambassadors and trying to win as many souls as we possibly can, because the end is certainly definite. There's no equivocation. There's no waffling here. It is what it is going to be. You have just read it. 1 John 2:17 says, "And the world passeth away, and their lust thereof, but he that doeth the will of God abideth forever." Very simply, I just wanted to give you sort of an understanding. This morning, as we, this morning's message, as I preach through and I talk about this world, I'm going to use that word. I'm not going to define it like I did this morning, but I hope that that gives you a fuller understanding of what we mean when we talk about the world. Let's pray. Father, thank you for this time. Thank you, Father, so much for your word. Every single time we open it, what a privilege and blessing, encouragement and education it is for us. Your word truly is profitable in all ways, and we thank you for it. Pray for your blessing on the service. In your name I pray. Amen.